Okay, this is an interview with Becky Basler. Can you spell your name?
B-E-C-K-I-B-A-S-Z-L-E-R.
And the date is the 1st of May, 1989. The recording is being done at the Counseling Center, Michigan State University. If you could give me your... Do I have on my sheet a request for a home address?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Now, if you could just go down that sheet now.
Okay. I am 21 years old, and I'm a junior at Michigan State University. My major is engineering arts, and my home address is Sheboygan, Michigan.
Can you give me a street address, too?
Oh, I'm sorry. 4909 Carlson Road, Sheboygan, Michigan.
Okay. I just want to make... Let's start off with something simple. Just describe your hometown, the street. Just give me a physical description of the houses, the street, the environment, whether it was an urban setting, whether you were outside outside of the city limits, or, you know, just...
My town or where
your
I live?
Your town.
Okay. My town is has approximately 6,500 people in it. It's kind of a smaller town. It's spread out along the river, the Sheboygan River, which leads into one of the Great Lakes. The industry is, you know, Procter & Gamble is a big industry there. Back in the old days, a lot of the logging used to be very popular. It's expanding. We're getting a lot of the fast food, you know, places. Right, currently we only have like McDonald's and Pizza Hut and Big Boy, but we're starting to get a Burger King and a couple of the places like that in. I live about 8 miles outside of my city. I live in the country, and my nearest neighbor is probably a couple blocks away. It's really pretty out there. I live, there's, we live on 40 acres of woods. We have 70 acres of hay. We used to, as small children, we used to have animals, a horse and a cow and chickens and bunnies and kind of like a small farm. I guess my town's what you call a small town in certain aspects. There's quite a few students from my town that do end up going to college and that, but overall, I mean, as far as like the movies coming up, you know, coming up to my city, you know, we don't reach them in the prime time like a lot of the larger, bigger cities do. We don't have all the shopping malls and that type of thing.
Well, yeah. Did you do any farm duties? Did you haul the hay or slop the pigs or things like that? Did you actually have a farm?
My dad was born and raised in a farm, so he wanted us to have an aspect, you know, of the different types of animals and that. I guess you'd say we butchered chickens, you know, I was able to go through that and plucking the feathers off and, you know, and that type of thing, you know, cooking them. We fed our horse and our cow, you know, as far as, you know, riding them. Like I said, we took care of bunny rabbits and had tons of cats and dogs. The hay, we probably did hay for about 5 summers when we had our horse.
You said you butchered the chickens. You butchered the chickens or your father did?
Well, as we were little kids, I was like 8 or 9, and you know, my dad would, you know, cut off their heads, and you know, first we would catch them, and then he would do that, and then, you know, we'd all take turns. I was from a family of four. And I would, you know, pluck off the feathers, and then my mom, you know, would you know, clean them and cook them and that.
When you look back on that background as lived growing up with a father who had a background in farming, are you glad that, I mean, do you have any response to that? You've talked to people who have lived in cities all of their lives.
I think it's a very good education, very good experience. My parents are both school teachers, and my dad, he would also have liked to have had a farm. You know, not a very large farm, obviously, you know, working 2 jobs, but on the side. But Sheboygan is just not quite the farming country to really have a lot of, you know, get a lot of really good crops or growth out of it.
What did you want to be when you were that young? Did you have any hopes and dreams in particular?
I started out and I wanted to be first a school teacher. You know, both my parents are school teachers, and you know, going there and seeing them teach in the classrooms, plus being in the classroom myself. You know, seeing the things that they do on the side, and you know, out of the classroom. Probably I don't remember exactly what age, but then I wanted to be a doctor. And probably wanted to be a doctor for a long time until 5th grade when I flew an airplane. Then I thought maybe I wanted to be a pilot of an airplane. And then I went back to being a doctor up until about 2 years ago when I changed my mind and decided to be in engineering.
What caused all of these particular interests?
I think my parents being school teachers had a very, you know, substantial emphasis. You know, they didn't try to persuade us. In fact, they tried to persuade us just the opposite. You know, saying, you know, do what you'd like, you know, leave your options open. Medicine, I have had a fairly healthy family, but when they, you know, really did, you know, get sick, I'm very sensitive and that type of thing. And I think I really, wanting to, you know, care for people and wanting to find cures for cancer and find cures for different types of diseases. And plus with my animals, you know, cats or dogs getting sick and not being able to do something about that, I think that really, you know, stuck hard in me.
Can you describe the high school that you went to, the number of students that were there, whether you felt it was challenging?
I went to a small Class B high school. There was 190 students in my graduating class, approximately 1,000 students overall. We had approximately 200 of those 1,000 students that were shared time students with a couple of the surrounding small schools around us, because we offered a lot more classes than some of the other very, very small Class D schools around us. I think overall our curriculum was very good. It kept, you know, getting better. You know, they just, for some reason during my four-year period, they had a surge of a lot of retirements and hired a lot of very excellent new teachers, you know, most of them which I had. The only thing I regret, I guess you'd say regret or wish that I would have had, is when I came to Michigan State here, I had never really even heard of advanced placement, you know, taking AP classes. My school only offered an honors English class, of which I took for 2 years. We didn't have any honors chemistry, honors math, you know, of which I would have liked to have had. You know, I had 1 year of chemistry, whereas I come to Michigan State and I'm competing with students who've had three or four, and maybe a couple of those, you know, were honors years, and they've also taken the AP classes. In waived, you know, some credits, or, you know, came in with some credits, you know, and I'm my ability to compete with them was fine at that level. I just had to initially work a little harder because I hadn't had the extra couple of years of chemistry or math or whatever particular class I was studying.
So are you telling me that you don't think you were properly prepared compared to other students?
No, I think I was properly prepared. It's just that a lot of the larger schools offer more. Some people call them AP classes, some call them honor classes, whereas that if you take those classes, then you can take the AP test in order to come in with, let's say, 21 credits, versus, you know, they were already almost sometimes a half a year to a full year jump on me credit-wise, as far as initially getting out sooner, I guess you would say.
But the net result is that you had to work harder initially, but now that you've caught up with them. Is that correct?
Well, it's kind of like if you and I both took the same class and I've had 5 years chemistry experience and you've never had a chemistry class in your life, you know, working on that type of a level. Obviously, they're going to, you know, some of the stuff that to me that's initially hard, which, you know, would maybe seem like cake to them, like if they went back and started doing timetables or something.
But now that you've been at Michigan State for?
For 3 years.
3 years, aren't you on a par with?
Oh, yeah. I figured at the end of my freshman year I was just initially. You end up having to study a lot more and really learn to weed out, you know, what I didn't have that was.
Well, now, did that adjustment from high school to college, that was one of the realizations you made. Here I am competing with students who have had a much greater body of knowledge than I do, or some of them have had mm-hmm. many more advanced placement courses, whatever you call them. And that must have been a little bit of a shock.
Not really. I was one of the few, one of the rare students in my high school. I graduated salutatorian, and so I already had very good study habits. You know, I knew how to study. I knew how to take notes, knew how to outline, you know, that type of thing. Whereas a lot of students blew off the classes in high school or didn't study or didn't, you know, take them very seriously. And that was, you know, comes as a real shock when they come here. It's just the amount, the type of classes. Our curriculum, the school was so small that our curriculum, you know, we wouldn't have had enough students to offer. I mean, they offered like a pre-calculus class beyond the algebra and geometry, and we had like maybe 25 students in our class of the more honors considered type of students. There just wasn't, this, you know, as many students there to require a class like that. you know, and plus, you know, with the budget and hiring another teacher and that, you know, a lot of restrictions like that.
Well, in making the jump from high school to college, it sounds as though you were well prepared. Well, one reason would be the influence of your parents. They were both school teachers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they must have given you good, steady habits. You were saying that you had good, steady habits. These didn't come out of a vacuum. And that a lot of your other students, fellow students in high school, blew their courses off, mm-hmm. I think is the phrase you used. What was the basic difference between you and these other students? Was it the parents? What motivated you that didn't motivate them?
I don't know. My parents never said, you have to do well. I mean, they obviously didn't want you failing classes. You know, they tried to help you when you had questions. They actually would try to get me not to study. You know, they say, well, don't study so much. You know, you're spending too much time studying. You know, go out and have fun, do this or that. I knew, like I said, very early I wanted to be a doctor, and I knew you had to have almost perfect, excellent grades, you know, 3.8, you know, very, very close to all A's, 4.0, whatever you call it, to get into medical school. And that was very important to me, so I knew that I would have to, you know, keep up my grades. And I think that's, you know, one of the initial, plus I'm a very perfectionist, and you're not going to know something if you halfway put yourself into a class. You're not going to know something completely.
Now you have three siblings?
Mm-hmm.
Do they have the same perfectionist attitude?
One does, and the other two are quite close.
So you are all strivers?
Mm-hmm. I would say I probably, you know, I don't know if they stereotype it being, you know, the oldest, but I'm probably the most overachiever in my family out of the four of us.
Is this because you, as the oldest, were expected to set the example?
No. No, not at all.
Where does this come from?
I don't
siblings who don't do anything.
Right. I think, like I said, all I can really relate it to is you know, knowing that I wanted to go to medical school and that if I wanted to be a doctor, I had to have very good grades. I had to keep up my knowledge and, you know, keep increasing it in doing well. And
but to be a doctor is to do something which, by comparison to a lot of other vocations, is very noble,
mm-hmm.
on the spectrum of things,
mm-hmm.
as they're judged. So you must have seen yourself as a person who wanted to do something important in life, as opposed to running a gas station or running a business or something
right.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that come from?
I'm really not sure. I just...
Are you religious?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a connection there?
I don't think so, maybe, except for in the way of, you know, wanting to help people, to heal people, you know, to make people happy. You know, that's probably my ultimate goal in life. You know, I like doing little special little, you know, things like that for people.
That is the traditional Christian attitude, to be compassionate, to help others,
mm-hmm.
isn't it? Where does your own self-satisfaction fit into the spectrum?
I guess I try to put myself in the position of others, and I look at myself and see what makes me happy. You know, whether it be, you know, like a birthday card for somebody on my birthday or something, you know, or, you know, an extra if I'm having a bad day and someone can sense that in me versus me, you know, showing it or any type of feeling. You know, people taking the extra effort or the extra, you know, or how you're feeling today or, you know, the extra little thing that someone would do.
Are you talking about an effort which you are making in behalf of someone else's problems, or are you talking about the satisfaction that you get when someone does something?
A little bit of both. Because I try to feel, I mean, I'm like I said before, I'm very sensitive, and maybe sometimes oversensitive, and I try, you know, to realize, you know, how would I like to be treated, and I try to, you know, treat people or you know, the way that I would like to be, or the way that I maybe not very often get a chance to, you know, and a lot of it, I think, has to do with people's backgrounds and how they were brought up. Like I said, I'm a resident assistant at Floor, and some people just don't have the consideration, you know, or like you said, you know, the compassion, and it's not because that they don't feel it, maybe, but they just, you know, something that they maybe, you know, wasn't shown very much in their home, or they weren't really brought up with, and so didn't, you know.
Do you think it's too late to educate them?
No, but I think their ways since they're older is going to be a little harder to change, you know, take a little longer, you know, or maybe not changing people. That's true. Well, my family is always very loving, very touching, you know, very very, very supportive and caring of each other, and I think that had a lot to do with it.
Do you consider your background unusual in that sense?
Not unusual, but I wouldn't say it's very, very common for nowadays society, you know, with mothers and fathers working, although my parents both did, but I think people a lot of times get caught up in themselves.
How do you mean that?
Well, like I worked for General Motors this summer, and, you know, as on a full-time basis and realizing maybe what I will do when I get out of here. And by the time, you know, you work your 40-hour week and, you know, you come home, do a little exercise for yourself or you know, have some enjoyment, social life for yourself, go out to a movie with friends or whether, you know, be with a, you know, your spouse or your boyfriend or whoever it may be, clean your house, you know, do the grocery shopping. I mean, it doesn't seem like there's enough time. And so I think a lot of times parents don't end up spending a lot of time, whether it be social or just teaching.
But how did you feel at the end of that 40 hours? I presume you were working full time.
I was taking two classes too.
In other words, how could you avoid not falling into that trap having a very self-centered world and only doing things for yourself? I mean, you're exhausting yourself 40 hours a week for some large corporation.
Mm-hmm.
How about the projects that you work on? Is that something from which you could see a result on a weekly basis, or was mm-hmm. this some distant project which was contributing to some body of research that would reveal itself 5 years down the road? You don't mm-hmm. have the same immediacy as you do if you run your own grocery store and you put the boxes of Wheaties on the shelves and you
right.
know that you've done a decent job,
mm-hmm.
or you pluck a chicken and cook it that night.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little bit ridiculous. But do you know what I'm saying? If you're working with General Motors and it's a very involved project, how is it possible within that framework to get any self-satisfaction?
I did realize, I think, you know, an internship is a very good experience. I like General Motors. I may end up working for them someday, but I think I probably would like to work for a smaller corporation either initially or eventually after a couple of years at General Motors because of that fact. You know, you don't see a lot of the satisfaction sometimes. You know, it may take you a while to become one of the higher rungs in the ladder, as they say, you know, one of the top dogs. And so where you could actually be there and, you know, and see more of that than just, you know, person who's initially doing the I don't say the low level work, but people who's actually doing the work versus the people, someone who's presenting, you know, it at a meeting or seeing more of the satisfaction of it.
Were you aware of the politics within the office?
Oh, very much so. Mm-hmm.
Describe them. You don't have to name names.
No, I don't really see any difference. Like I said, my parents are school teachers. I've seen a lot of the out of the side, you know, school politics. We're supposed to be educating the students, and there's still, unfortunately, a lot of politics on who gets hired and who goes where, and you know, whether it be, you know, sports politics or whether it be they need a new history teacher, and they also need a new football coach, so it just happens he can do both, and they have, you know, or if there's someone, you know, in the district, you know, residency, sometimes they live in or out of the districts come into, you know, a problem. And I think that's very much the same thing like with General Motors. I just saw it on a lot larger scale, you know, a lot of the comparisons. Going back again to the person who works a lot and doesn't have time for much anyone else, basically, or maybe not anyone else, doing things outside of his own, you know, little world or her world. My bosses, you know, they came in almost every Saturday and Sunday and put in almost a complete 8-hour day on each one of those days that they didn't even get paid for. Once in a while they would claim that overtime, but if you claim too much overtime during a certain pay period, it's not going to look very good in reflection on your work. People would be like, well, you're costing us too much money, you know, we'll get, you know, rid of you. I mean, that's not what they said in a sense, but it, you know, you kind of got that feeling, which makes sense, I'm sure, with any, you know, any company. If you can't get the amount of work done within a certain lot of time, plus a little bit of overtime here and there during busy periods, we might as well get rid of you, save money, get someone who can do the work, because maybe they think, you know, they would feel that you're not doing the work on time or you're not putting quality time into the work.
How about the purpose, the goal they have in mind? Their end goal is to come out with a car which is more competitive than somebody else's car.
Mm-hmm.
Who cares? We have too many cars in the world anyway. Why don't you go back and become a doctor and pursue something which is more humanitarian? Now you're... I'm trying to antagonize you
mm-hmm.
a little bit, but
that's
I mean,
fine.
Now you're stuck in an engineering world which has this lousy corporate structure, and you're going to get gobbled up politically and in terms of the layers, the strata of the corporation itself. Do you go back and think about what it might have been if you had pursued your interest in medicine?
Well, my first reason for not pursuing medicine is because when I got to college, I decided that versus being here for 8 years, getting out when I was about 28, 29, or it should be almost 10 years by the time I did an internship, but getting out, you know, 10 years later, being almost 30, say 28, then to, I've heard from many people that it takes approximately 10 years to pay off the debt that you've been in before you even really start, you know, establishing either your own practice or just in general, you know, paying off your debt and start even, you know, making a reasonable income to savings. Versus I would be about 38, by that time start, you know, having a family, and I'd like to have 4 kids, and I just don't see the time for all that. So for, you know, I guess making a sacrifice for wanting to have a husband and having 4 kids and having them earlier than 38, you know, was my main reason for changing out.
Are you telling me that the basic interest in a family and a shorter payoff period, to put it crudely, mm-hmm. has taken sway over the humanitarian interest that you had in working as a doctor?
That was one of the big main reasons.
Yeah.
I think maybe as a freshman I might have decided a little too soon. I was also, I think, getting very maybe tired of school, wanting to be out, you know, seeming like 10 years. I think I took the wrong approach, like, oh my goodness, I'm going to be 10 more years in school, versus thinking, you know, take it a term at a time, take it a year at a time. Because my last 3 years have flown by, you know, and figuring I would only have my last 3 years. Wow, this is my third year here. They've just flown by, you know, figuring maybe I don't have 6 more years left. I mean, it looks so much different. 7 more, it looks so much different. You know, I think I looked at it as too long. You know, thinking 10 years, wow, I've already been in school at 13, you know, in that respect.
Do you think there's something wrong with the basic structure of going through high school, immediately going into college, immediately going into grad school or med school or business school or so forth, and then going into vocation? You spend the first 28, 29 years of your life only in school. You've never really worked, except mm-hmm. for possibly selling milkshakes at McDonald's.
Right,
sometimes. My question to you is, why should a young person be forced to make a major decision with respect to his or her vocation, never having taken any major responsibility of any kind other than going to school?
That's a good question. I had thought of, you know, about that before, maybe not as in much, you know, detail as you're requiring me to do right now. I don't know. I think that people have an idea, you know, with the classes that they take, you know, with, like I said, with, you know, me thinking as a little kid I wanted to be a school teacher, seeing my parents, seeing different things. I think a lot of people are really scared, you know, obviously, you know, where am I going to, you know, be, what am I going to be doing? And people are so worried and upset about a specific job or specific, you know, occupation major that they're going to take and select for the rest of their lives. And on the average, I believe it's that you make about 4 different drastic job changes. And a lot of people who, when they get out with a major, they're doing a job that doesn't even, or career, if you want to use the word, doesn't even relate to their major, really. You know, I think that the internships or some practical type of experience, whether you get paid or not, that people, universities or corporations or any kind of company has been, you know, requiring over the last couple of years, or suggesting, you know, strongly suggesting, is very helpful. It lets you know, hey, I don't like this, you know, before you spend the next couple of years in college or before you go out and work at a job that you're not very happy at.
GMI in Flint has a program where mm-hmm. you work for 8 weeks and go to school for 8 weeks.
Right.
I forget what it is, but. Well, let me hop over to another subject. You, as an RA, have been exposed to a lot of problems simply because you are directly aware of what's going on your floor. And so you encounter, particularly, I would suppose, among the freshmen, what problems they're having since they're required to live in the dorm for the first year. Can you describe some of those problems? What's going on? What's the basic problem that an incoming freshman has? How would you sum that up?
I can speak from my point of view. I'm an RA and mostly an undergraduate hall, so I have mostly juniors, seniors. I'm on a co-ed floor this year, where I have approximately 22 males and 22 females. And so most of those are juniors, and some of them are transfer students. I probably have half the floor, which is transfer students. And I've seen a lot of correlation between the student transferring from a two-year junior college or from one-year junior college and the freshman. The transfer student usually has better study habits than a freshman coming out of high school, because they're not used to a typical freshman coming out of high school is not used to the workload, you know, the fast, heavy pace of the classes, you know, shorter terms, shorter weeks, test, you know, weekly or maybe one major test versus a bunch of little quizzes that they had in high school for their grade, you know, for the particular class. I think that the transfer students still have a lot of questions. I mean, this university is so large, they don't know where a lot of the resources, and they still don't know a lot of the resources. You know, they don't know maybe the counseling service or maybe just the main ones, you know, the library, Olin Health Center. You know, there's a lot of resources that they could use that could help them, you know, and as an RA, it's our position, you know, to inform them of that, but you only can do so much informing and through bulletin boards and through flyers and through programs.
Could you comment on their social adjustment, particularly the freshmen? After all, they're breaking away from their parents for the first time. They're, in some cases, drinking for the first time. Mm-hmm. They're going crazy with parties for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Again, I lived mostly last year in freshman and sophomore hall, and this year mostly in junior senior, so I see a lot of the differences. And speaking for myself as a freshman, we do have approximately 120 freshmen out of 1,200 students in my hall, but that's still not a large percentage. So looking at it from my point as being a freshman, they freshmen and sophomores do come in a lot of times, like you said, you know, first time away from home, first time, you know, no parents, no ruling. I don't have to be, you know, don't have to come in at a curfew. I had a lot of my transfer students tell me, and they're like 19, 20, and 21. They're like, no curfew, wow, we can go out to the bar every night, and you know, and they have a lot of those first away from home feelings too. A lot of homesickness in a transfer student and in a freshman. Something of which I never felt, I guess just because I had gone away to church camps, to 4-H camp, to Girl State, French club trips, just different things, you know. A lot of the freshmen, you know, are scared. Coming away, you know, for the first time, they have to do their own laundry. You know, they cooking and cleaning, you know, basically is done for them. They clean their own rooms, and I think just the initial, the university is so large. You know, they're encountering phone bills or maybe Visa or MasterCard bills or something like that. You know, first type of, you know, actual responsibility.
What's going
as
on here? They've been coddled
charges.
Too much. They're 19 years old, and they have problems doing their laundry. Should a mother be doing her son's or daughter's laundry until they're 18 or 19?
I don't think so. There are a lot of people who are very well adjusted. In some instances, maybe like let's say with laundry, you know, they can handle their own laundry, their own cooking. But when it comes to like they maybe the financial situation, they don't have a checking account. They maybe have a small savings account. A lot of students don't even know what they pay here for classes. They mail their payments home to their parents. Their parents pay them out and keep track of them. You know, they really have no idea. Their parents send them a blank check to write for books. I think it's very unhealthy in that respect because, you know, they should have to send their phone bills home, too. I think students should have to, you know, start some type of money, not only for good credit reasons, but start some type of money account, you know, learn how to make checks, learn how to write them out. I got a big kick out of it when I first went to registration. It's this great big huge sign on how to write out the checks. Your name goes here, right? Michigan State here, right? You know, and they actually had, you know, how to write out the numbers too on a check. You know, I mean, I've heard some older people, you know, I'm saying older, I was like in 40, 45, who still get confused as to where to write the and or the no over the 100 or whatever in writing on a check. But I think students need parents sometimes, you know, maybe shelter or, you know. I know my parents, I never had any problem adjusting, but I didn't get a checking account until I came to college so that I could, you know, make out my own bills and that type of thing. Just my parents never really saw a need for me to want to have more money, so it's too easy to write out checks, they said.
Do you think the society is at fault? Are parents generally coddling their children for too long a period? Should they be given more responsibility earlier? Do you have any overall perceptions? Is this?
I think in general I would have to say yes, that I think that they should. A lot of parents, I think sometimes, you know, they know how to do it. It's much quicker, easier for them to you know, do the laundry for their child versus the child messing it up or checking account, you know, versus bills or having charge cards and charging too much and the parents, you know, have to bail them out. I mean, I can see the parents, you know, I guess you'd say frustrations or need to want, like you said, you know, cuddle or protect them too much. You know, I mean, I see that in myself, and even like in babysitting kids, you know, things that would my parents let me do that I'm a little too afraid to let them do. But you have to let them break away sometime. I mean, I'm not saying like at 8 years old, you know, make them start, you know, doing atrocious responsibility tasks, but give them more of a sense of responsibility, not like you're putting it upon them, but so that they can, you know, feel the need that they're like still helping their parents.
Did your grade point average drop from high school to your first term freshman year?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
was that
did.
A shock?
No, because my counselor and my parents had always warned me, you know, when you get to college and you get your first B, you know, you're going to be horrified. And my counselor was actually more so than my parents. You know, he said, maybe if you fail your first class in college, he said, you're gonna, you know, it's going to be initially a really emotional shock for you because you're used to getting all A's in high school. I guess maybe just because of them warning me for that, you know. And then when I did get a B or something, I guess in a respect, I was devastated just, you know, for the fact that, like I said, I'm a perfectionist. And not necessarily that the A means that you do not know everything or that you do know everything, but it's just, I was just always doing very well. And I think that I knew that sometime there would come a time where the competition would be harder or somebody would be better than me, obviously in such a large university.
What was the biggest adjustment you had to make coming from high school to college, personally?
Like I said, I think study habits was really, I don't think really any problem. I didn't really have any problem as far as bills or laundry. I guess maybe I would say, and this might sound funny, but living with 50 girls on a floor, this is not something very small, but I'm a very light sleeper.
Okay, this is Real 2, interview with Becky Bassler. You were talking about the moving into a dorm for the first time with 50 girls and you're a light sleeper. Could you back up and give that description?
There was approximately 55 girls on my floor. I lived on a female quiet floor. My parents suggested, because I did like to study and because I was a light sleeper, to, you know, initially sign up for the floor. I'm very glad that I did. Sometimes quiet floors can become what they call a morgue, where they're just so dead and so closed door that nobody really knows each other. It's not a very open community. People do things socially besides as well as study. And my floor, thank goodness, you know, had open doors, had music going sometimes, had social communication, interaction, movies, you know, that type of thing, besides the academic study life. I think what was hard for me, my sister and I, we shared a room together until 14, so as far as, you know, being an only child, or of which I wasn't, but my roommate was an only child, so it was really hard, I think, for her. I know we got in little differences, you know, over things in the room and that type of thing.
Can you give an example?
When we moved in, she kind of placed everything where she wanted to, which is really unlike me to allow her to do that. not that I'm not willing to compromise, but I'm very, very much of a leadership type person, and usually would give my input. I'd like to have my say too about a room I'm going to live in for the whole year, of where things be placed, you know, for
the
tipping. Well, we moved in, and you know where she wanted the desk facing. We built a loft, so you know we both slept up in the loft, but underneath, you know, just the stereo, refrigerator, TV, that type of thing. You know.
Did you broach the subject? What happened? The desk is not where it should be. I'm your roommate. Now what do you do?
Well, we ended up changing it at the beginning of every term, and so the next term, you know, we kind of like drew a map and decided, you know, it took her a little while to learn. She was, you know, used to having her own room, having her own things, no one touching anything. I really, thank goodness, I guess you could say, I really didn't mind where she put some of the stuff, so I really didn't say anything. And that's been one of the biggest things that I had to learn in college, and I really learned the lesson the hard way with her. I have opinions, and I usually do express them, you know, as far as the leadership type form. But sometimes I'm too nice or too sensitive, and don't want to hurt other people's feelings, and don't let them know how I feel. For instance, I would offer her, I'd bring up food or pop, whatever, and I'd offer her, you know, a can of pop or some food or whatever, and she just took the initiative that I offered once, so anything in the room of mine she's allowed to take or touch or use. And it irritated me, and you know, I would tell my parents about it, I'd tell my sleepmate about it, but I didn't talk to her soon enough. I let it bother me a little while first before you know, we happened to talk about it. And you know, I think that, you know, that was wrong, lack of communication, and you know, and in that respect, I guess it was she was actually doing, I guess you'd say, harm indirectly to me by using my things and, you know, that type of thing, whether, you know, my coat would be gone if I wanted to use it or something like that. But I didn't come out initially and tell her.
Is this a common problem among new roommates, particularly in freshman year?
Yes, very much so. Actually, in with anyone. I just recently, as an RA, I have a 22-year-old girl and a 24-year-old girl who are sweet mates. And since day one, they haven't liked each other, but have kind of tolerated each other. You know, it's been touch and go. I've you know, had a lot of different talks with each of them individually and then together. And finally, it came to where I had to write up a written contract. We had to sit down, and each one of them had to, they couldn't face each other. They would actually start, like, punching each other or screaming at each other.
Physically fighting?
Yes. They're 22 and 24. They had to actually face opposite, kind of like diagonally at me, not even looking at each other, talk to me, the other person could hear, but talk to me of what they wanted to say, what the other person didn't like, or, you know, what, how they wanted the contract to work out. And, you know, then she would be quiet, and then I'd let her talk, and that type of thing. They could not look at each other. I mean, we had to set ground rules like this. To me, that was very, very sad to have it come to that point. But there has been, I mean, that's not the first, that's the first or the second conflict in that respect that's come, you know, to that harsh of terms. On my floor, but some other floors have even been worse. You know, the residence hall, they try to be, you know, try to fit people who are compatible, but they're not going to make your room with someone that you're going to absolutely fight with like that. But neither one of these girls wanted to move out of their room. But they actually would, they only shared a bathroom. I could just imagine what it would be like if they were roommates. It was, we had to, you know, get down to, you know, you could only have 15 minutes in the bathroom. We had to, you know, draw certain lines of certain things they could touch and not touch in the bathroom. Each person got so many squares or so many inches of the medicine cabinet and of the room on the floor underneath the sink. And it was really, to me, it was very sad.
So you become a therapist or psychologist in a way. You're trying to resolve an emotional problem they're having.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know what the roots of it were? Do they know what the roots of this were?
Well, one person, she's 20, 24. She's been away from home for the first time. She's been a little, from what I gather from her and from her friends and from other people, she's been more of a little princess at home, you know, do no wrong, mom, you know. And she's really had a hard time adjusting coming here. So, you know, you try to take that into consideration. Like I said, and she's, both these students are transfer students. So it's both their first year away from home. In a lot of respects, they're very mature. You know, drinking-wise, I would say they're more mature than the average freshman. But coming up here initially, there's just tons of freedom, and they may be loud, or they may stay up later, or be a little more obnoxious and ignorant, maybe, in a sense, you know, even though they may be 20, 21, 22, you know, whatever their age may be. You know, and the same would probably happen to me. I mean, just new things that I hadn't experienced living here for 2 years, you know, living out on your own.
Do you think there's a difference in the way men and women handle this problem? If two guys, two sweet mates, weren't getting along like that, they'd probably go out in the hall and bash one another's brains out.
Right.
Now, the two women ended up being very spiteful, not talking to one another, didn't even look at one another.
They talked behind each other's backs very, very viciously. We have a floor table that we sit at, and if one girl was sitting there, the other girl would not sit there. She'd go to, you know, to another table and sit. And, you know, it really made people uncomfortable at the floor table because they'd be talking about each other. And some of them would be friends with both of them and friends with, you know, not with, you know, one or the other. And just, either they couldn't say much of it to each other's face, but they were very, versus their big outbursts. Every once in a while they get in a big fight, like how I happened to say, all right, this is it, we're sitting down, you know, either one of, you know, I couldn't say you have to move out or you have to move out because I can't do that as a university figure. Neither can the, you know, housing clerk or whoever, because you can't legally force someone out of their room, you know, type of deal. But neither one of them would move. They hated each other. They hated rooming together or suiting together. You know, one said one took 40 minutes in the shower, and the other person said, will you take 10 minutes or, you know, doing such and such, or, you know, it was just incredible, you know, and stories are different as night and day. Each person's right, and their stories don't even, I could hardly find any times that they matched. You know, they were screaming and yelling out in the hall at each other, slamming doors and swearing at the top of their lungs. It's how I heard this down in my room, which is, they're at one end of the hall, and I'm almost at the other end of the hall. How I first, you know, come across the type of problem.
There's a lot of debate about the drinking and whether it should be controlled more or less, whether it's just forget it and give people complete freedom, whether the university has a responsibility to step in and exercise more discipline, more regulations, and so forth. What do you feel about all of that? What are your opinions? The drinking in the dorms?
I'm very much in favor of rules and in favor of laws and in obeying them. I didn't, again, this is just me, but I never drank through high school at all, and I never drank through college. I just recently this year turned 21, and I've probably had 3 drinks since then when we went out to Chi-Chi's for dinner or something. The only drinking I did before that was our family. We'd always like have a glass of wine for Christmas, Easter. Yeah, you know, that type of dinners.
How do you withstand the temptation? All of these freshmen and college kids are going out, and they're going to, many of them go to an excess. They drink themselves silly, and yet you've remained temperate. Aren't you tempted?
No. I don't, maybe just because I really don't like, I mean, I do not like beer at all. I guess for me, just maybe I've acquired a taste over the years, you know, since 10 or 12 of having a glass of wine at dinner. But I do like wine. I like fine wines. I don't like just any cheap Boone's Hill or whatever it is that people go out and buy $2.50 a bottle. I do like a nice glass of wine with a nice meal. I don't know. I don't really...
Is it relaxing?
I don't really drink that much to really, you know, I mean, as far as even getting a type of a buzz or anything like that, you know, one glass, I guess maybe just more so the taste of it. I know a lot of students, you know, they're like, well, I had a huge test week and I'm going to go out and get drunk and throw up. And to me, I mean, I'm a pretty healthy person. I, you know, get the flu maybe once a year, you know, colds, you know, and I don't enjoy having the flu for those 24 hours that I have it, or 48 hours. And to me, the idea of rewarding yourself for doing well on a test and studying out, you know, and going out and you know, vomiting, it's just not, to me, that's not, first of all, it's ridiculous. Second of all, it's not very smart. And third of all, I don't enjoy being sick. And to me, from the way they describe it, you know, or the hangovers the next morning, it doesn't sound, I don't understand sometimes the people's reasoning for it. You know, I mean, I do have friends that do it. I've seen, you know, my students, you know, or my residents on my floor. But like when we go out to bars or something like that, I probably 3 years in college, been out to the bar maybe 8 times. I love to dance. I would be dancing at the bar every night if I could. This is funny. I love to dance, but I never wanted to be like a ballerina or anything like that. But I don't, you know, people are like, oh, you go to the bar, go to the bar. I don't go to the bar at all to drink. You know, even if I did like to drink, I probably wouldn't drink at the bar because drinks are so expensive at the bar. I really don't know what makes students want to go nuts over it. But I definitely think that they talk about the RA job next year being police officer, rule enforcement. In some respects, it's going to alienate the RAs even more than it already does some of the students. A lot of the rules that they're trying to enforce, making it stricter, are already written in Spartan Life and in the rule, you know, in the, you know, the guideline, the rule books, student handbooks, excuse me. But RAs and you know the RDs, and we don't enforce them to the fullest. And I think next year, you know, from what I'm reading, from what I'm understanding, it's going to be, we're going to be enforcing them, you know, to the fullest.
So you become a police officer.
In a sense. I really don't, right now, I don't think the compensation of room and board is enough for an RA. You know, you have a 24-hour-a-day job. You have, you know, you might have a couple days that are perfect, and then you might have a week of a lot of problems, you know. It doesn't balance out per hourly rate of whatever, you know, the hours. But again, you know, they say if you're going to be an RA, you shouldn't go into it for the financial. It's excellent experience, excellent leadership. I think you really understand yourself more. You understand people even more so, I would say, than yourself. It may be good for you and it may be bad for you, depending upon what type of person you are. You know, you might, a lot of people think, oh, free room board, I'll do it, but they don't initially realize what the job takes. Minus the bulletin boards, minus name tags, you know, that type of thing. Minus being a resource person, the actual physical, emotional, communicational, you know, dealing with students, confronting behavior is a big thing.
You feel that you've grown in the job?
Mm-hmm.
You said earlier that with your roommate that initially you had a little bit of trouble expressing your opinion on small things.
Mm-hmm.
If that same quality extended itself into your job, it would mean that you would also have a little bit of trouble in telling suite mates, for example, to get their act together, whatever that might have meant. But if you're growing in your job, then theoretically you're overcoming that. You're mm-hmm. becoming more assertive, more aggressive.
Right.
More like
I was always fairly assertive, fairly aggressive. It's just in certain instances I wouldn't, you know, such as in dealing with my roommate. It took me about 2 terms, and then finally the 3rd term, you know, we sat down and we had a talk, and it turned out fairly well. She has hard feelings, and so to this day she doesn't really speak much more than a hi or something like that to me, to my suite mates, and to a lot of the people on our sister floor, or on the floor that I lived on. She has had a lot of problems with people and a lot of conflicts. I don't know if she's just trying to avoid it completely, you know, or what the deal may be. But I think it's definitely, you know, something that I learned, you know, probably even one of the downfalls maybe I had in like in high school and elementary. But I wouldn't say you overcome it completely, because I still, you know, think maybe I'd like to be, I don't know if you call it gullible or if you call it naive. I like to give people the benefit of the doubt. I'm very trusting of people. Maybe sometimes too trusting in a way that, you know, because I'm, you know, sensitive and end up getting hurt. But you know, blow my trust or you do something to make, you know, I guess I keep going back to trust. I can't think of another word right now. Break my trust, blow my trust, whatever. And I'm not going to trust you again. I'm going to be very, you know, it would be nice to you. I would treat you decently in that. You may still be a friend of mine, but as far as telling you any secret or trusting you with a lot of money or something very substantial, I wouldn't. You know, and you would know that, because It wouldn't be, I mean, like I said, I wouldn't treat you differently in the respect that I wouldn't, you know, if I had $5 and I would want you to hang on to it for me, or if I had a big check and I was, you know, going swimming or something, you know, I just wouldn't, you know, whether it be money. And a lot of that leads from back in high school when I had my locker. We had school lockers in high school. And I had like probably $50 in candy money. We're selling candy to go to France, you know, stolen. And I've had locker partners who swear they didn't give out the combination to anybody else, you know, they probably told a friend who, you know, got in there, you know, and just different little things. And it seems to be that I'm unlucky that my car recently just got, you know, vandalized before it got crashed. It got vandalized in X lot, the window smashed in. They didn't take anything, but it, you know, caused a lot of problems as far as, you know, taking it to the car insurance. I'm not from down here, and a lot of different things like that.
There are two basic areas. How are we doing for time? Got a
20,
few minutes?
20 to 11.
What time would you feel comfortable leaving by?
11.
11.
Mm-hmm.
One is, how do you feel about the general quality of the courses here, the professors you've had? And if while you were talking, I've forgotten the other, but it will come back to me in a minute.
Okay.
Do you have a basic reaction? Have the quality of the courses come up to your expectations? Have you talk in terms of percentages, or whether you've disliked a certain course, or whether you, for example, dislike the courses with 300 people and a TV monitor, the 100 level, the general education courses? Or would you just talk at random?
Okay. Again, you know, you're talking about my grades and that from the past. I take education very importantly, and I've usually, not going by the grading the process book, but I've usually talked to students, or mostly students versus other professors, I would say, and asked about a professor, you know, what's their curriculum, how do they teach, you know, what do they stress, you know, do they just do mostly like a multiple choice test, do they have essay tests, you know, trying to get a feel for the professors and the way that they, you know, deal and handle with the classes, teach the subject. In I guess you'd say scouting out a professor or something before I even take the initial class. I don't want to take it, I mean, spending money here, I don't want to waste my time on a class I'm not going to learn anything, or on a professor who's not going to teach it or be, is very, you know, attendance is very important and a lot of things like that.
Once you take the class, though, what has been your reaction to the professor based on all of this preliminary investigation?
Excellent. I have probably had only one, I guess I would say one hard to say that he was good. Probably one bad professor. He's been very hard to deal with, not only on a personality level, but as far as asking class questions and the way that he lectures. He's come right out basically within the first week of class and told the class he doesn't want to be teaching the course that he's made to by the department. Very negative. He's even mentioned his family and his kids, you know, being very negative about them during the lectures. You know, I mean, that to me views upon a person's personality and how they perceive things. And he was not a very interesting lecturer. The material he was covering would have been interesting. He just seemed to be very pessimistic. And I'm very optimistic, but regardless of that, he just was not happy with the class, didn't want to be teaching it, wasn't very helpful in helping us. His test sometimes didn't cover the material that he covered in class or in the book, you know, had no idea where he got it from. Some of the TAs in the class had even taken, you know, the test, and he gives it to them as like a preliminary, and they had a very hard time with it. Now, if they're graduate students or if they're undergraduate, you know, seniors and having a hard time, I think maybe he should really evaluate the course being a freshman course.
This is one course, though.
One course out of everything.
Out mm-hmm. Since you've been here for almost 3 years, right? Which isn't a bad average.
No, not at all.
So you're happy with?
Mm-hmm. Like I said, though, I put a lot of time. Not only do I want my class to be on the day that I'd like it or during the times that I'd like it, but I really want you to have a very, you know, not necessarily good lecturer or easy test grader, but some professor that I'm going to learn a lot from. Because I know sometimes it's hard to be sitting out there every single day and be exciting or be informed, you know, besides being informative. be interesting, make it colorful, you know. And so, some of the classes aren't designed to be that way. They're, you know, more.
Let me hop over to another subject. I thought of the other question. If you could just close your eyes mentally or in your mind's eye, where do you see yourself in 10 years? Just describe the setting, the job, where you'll be living, whether you're going to have a family, one kid or 10 kids, are they going to be on a farm or what? Just go down a list of what the ideal requirements would be for a happy life 10 years down the road.
Well, 10 years down the road, I see myself married, possibly one, maybe two children at the time. I would like to be very well into my company, small or large corporation that I will be working with, hopefully. I'm very much of a business type person. I like to be very thorough, get things done, make a list, you know, that type of thing. Definite goals I've had throughout my life. I hope to be working, if not by 10 years, very soon after, a couple years after, I hope to be in, you know, president or vice president of a particular, section, I guess you would say, within a company, or if it may even be a small company, you know, be co-top person or something like that. That's ideally what I would like to do someday, is be a president of either my own company or of, you know, a company that I am working for.
And this would be related to your field of engineering?
Mm-hmm. Engineering / management, you know, in the area.
Now, that's juggling a lot of things. That's a family, kids, a husband, a job, and at the same time climbing to a high position within that corporation, mm-hmm. whatever structure it is. Is that too much? Can you really do all of that?
Well, all I can say is I'm going to try, and I certainly hope so, because I've had set very high goals for myself in the past and been able to manage, you know, not only time management, but as far as stress or you know, family, that type of thing, in the past. And I know the goals in the past probably have been smaller or been less time-consuming or less time slotted, I guess I would say, versus, you know, my whole life versus, you know, just certain years, 4 years in high school or 4 years, you know. But you work with small goals and work your way up to larger. And, you know, that's how you end up getting better, I guess you would say, in a certain area.
Did you look at the questionnaire at some point?
Mm-mm.
Never? I was going to ask you if there was any. Well, there's one question I do ask most of the people I've interviewed, and that is that you're going to end up with a typed transcript, which maybe you will pick up in 10 years. Now, what do you think you'd like to read of something that you said 10 years earlier? What really goes to the heart of your philosophy here without simply giving me the general rap of I want to be happy, I want to be productive and so forth, which everyone wants to be. Is there anything in particular about your attitude towards life or your philosophy of life that you might want to be able to see reflected in this transcript 10 years from now?
Well, I would say I recently just found out that a friend of mine who's very close, I've never had in my family, I had an uncle, a second uncle, who passed away, but a friend of mine is very close, he's very healthy, he's an excellent person, et cetera, et cetera. His major's philosophy, he was supposed to be graduating this term. They just found out he has cancer.
Oh.
And it's been very hard for me to handle, very hard for me to take, and this person's very idealistic. You know, just you would imagine the perfect, sweetest, wonderful person, you know, how could it happen to him, all those kinds of things. And I think with that happening and with my grandpa almost losing a hand just recently, and, you know, just like with my car and realizing how close that I, you know, came to maybe being hurt or, you know, being dying myself, I think that, you know, even though I have set high goals for myself and, you know, saying I want all this, not meaning that I'm cocky, But I've always been very sure of myself and what I want. You know, I know what I want and I go get it. But I think in the end that maybe, you know, I guess you would say family, or unfortunately I don't mean to say happiness, but I want to make sure I didn't leave out doing anything, or you know, say, well, Mom, I can't quite make it home this weekend, you know. Don't waste time, you know, doing, like you said, you know, climbing up the political corporate. Definitely reevaluate your life, I maybe would say, every couple of years, every, you know, or maybe just all the time, kind of like daily reminding yourself, because, you know, things are so important, and just to think that tomorrow he could be gone, you know, and we haven't, he goes to Michigan State, we haven't probably talked maybe in the last couple of months, just because Michigan State's so large and you hardly see each other as much. And it's just kind of shocking, you know, that it just really hits you hard. Did you?
Yeah. You did answer that, though, didn't you? Well, you didn't.
Kind of in a roundabout way, I feel.
Engineering arts. I hope you don't get gobbled up in some huge, eaten alive in some huge corporation.
Well, see, I think I'd end up getting out before I would end up having something like that happen, just for the fact that myself, what would I say? I'm very interested. I love to debate in high school. Debate, you know, we didn't have a debate team, but in classes now. I love politics. I went to Girl State. I became a senator. I ran for governor. Made it out of 19 people to the top three. I love the speaking and the politics and the government and understanding and all that type of thing. But I don't think I could ever. Law interested me at one time, but I don't think I could ever be a lawyer, at least not a courtroom lawyer, because if you know, guilty until proven, or innocent until proven guilty. If someone made me, you know, this guy was just, you know, suspected of murder, or, you know, pretty well sure, you know, five or six, you know, I don't know if I could represent him if I didn't feel, after listening to him, talking to witnesses, I don't know if they, you know, may put you with a person, because every person's supposed to have a lawyer in court. I don't know if I could represent someone like that, maybe that I didn't feel in my heart, you know. I mean, I may be wrong, and unfortunately, you know, hopefully you get a fair trial, but if I didn't feel I could represent them, and then having to do that. Or because of politics, because of the way the laws are worded, people end up getting off, you know, don't get the sentence they deserve, or don't even get put in jail. I really don't know how I could handle that, if I could deal with that.
You clearly don't want to go into law, or it seems to be that you're rejecting that.
Politics in general, you're talking about like politics and the political aspect. It's bad enough to deal with that in a job, let alone, like, if I ran for president. That's another thing I had said one day, too, that I someday will be the first woman president, or one of the first. I don't know if I could handle that or not in the campaigning. I mean, I wouldn't want to purposely try to dig up mud in my opponent. You know, we both campaign, we both give our views, both do what we, you know, feel we'll do, talk to the people, be sincere in the best man win, best woman win. But that's not how they campaign. That's not how they get ahead in the world. And that's just, I don't, maybe I won't be president of a company someday for that reason. I'm not going to be dog and cat world out there. That's just not me. Okay.
Oh, let's compete with that. You're taking a lot for granted, I think, that is in terms of your choices and options. Does it dawn on you that most people don't have these choices?
Choices in...
You can move in any direction you want, you can pick any location you want, you can get married, you can not get married, you can move to any part of the country that you want. I mean, when you compare your choices with somebody in a third world country.
Oh, okay, I understand what you're saying. I agree with you. Not only myself, but I think other any particular United States citizen, just we're so used to having, you know, so many appliances and choices, and a lot of people just assume they're going to go to college, you know, whereas some people, for others, are just, you know, they would be thankful to be able to go through high school, or thankful to be able to get, you know, three meals a day. One thing I think I've always said that I think I probably realized more than most people concerning that talking, stuttering here, that, we, as Americans, as far as like food, you know, we so many of us are overweight, you know, we take so much food for granted, throw away food. I worked at restaurants, and, you know, as far as the amount of food that we throw away and we think nothing of, most other people would just, you know, absolutely love it. Again, like college is a very costly 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, however long you may be here, PhDs, masters, that type of thing. It's very lucky that our society is very democratic, and I mean, it has a lot of, you know, cons to it too, but there's also a lot of pros and a lot of different things, you know, like as far as choices, whereas in well, like USSR, you know, if you're a great dancer, then, you know, you have to be that, or whatever, you know, use your skills. May not be what you want to do, but, you know, you need to, versus having, we might have it as a hobby, whereas they would have to do, you know, that type of thing. I don't know, maybe it's, you know, being raised American or being in the United States that would... I don't think I try to take it for granted, but I think when the power went out here a couple of weeks ago, we sure realized how much, you know, that you needed electricity, and you needed a lot of, people couldn't wash their soaps and they were devastated.
This concludes the interview with Becky Basler on 5/1/89, interview conducted by Bob Crawford.